Chapter 28. Recounting Sam Jones the Revivalist's reception in heaven. I was on the train, and was approaching the Celestial Way station. I had a through ticket and I noticed a man sitting alongside of me asleep, and he had his ticket in his hat. He was the remains of the Archbishop of Canterbury. I recognized him by his photograph. I had nothing against him, so I took his ticket, and let him have mine. He didn't object, he wasn't in a condition to object, and presently when the train stopped at the Heavenly Station, well, I got off, and he went on by request, but there they all were, the angels, you know, millions of them, everyone with a torch. They had arranged for a torchlight procession. They were expecting the Archbishop, and when I got off they started to raise a shout, but it didn't materialize. I don't know whether they were disappointed. I suppose they had a lot of superstitious ideas about the Archbishop, and what he should look like, and I didn't fill the bill, and I was trying to explain to St. Peter, and was doing it in the German tongue, because I didn't want to be too explicit. Well, I found it was no use. I couldn't get along, for Wayne McVie was occupying the whole place, and I said to Mr. Donna, "What is the matter with that man? Who is that man with the long tongue? What's the trouble with him, that long, lank cadaver, old oil derrick out of a job, who is that?" "Well, now," Mr. Donna said, "you don't want to meddle with him. You had better keep quiet. Just keep quiet, because that's a bad man. Talk. He was born to talk. Don't let him get out with you. He'll skin you." I said, "I have been skinned, skinned, and skinned for years. There is nothing left." He said, "Oh, you'll find there is. That man is the very seed and inspiration of that proverb which says, no matter how close you skin an onion, a clever man can always peel it again." Well, I reflected and I quieted down. That would never occur to Tom Reed. He's got no discretion. Well, McVie is just the same man. He hasn't changed a bit in all those years. He has been peeling Mr. Mitchell lately. That's the kind of man he is. Mr. Howells, that poem of his is admirable. That's the way to treat a person. Howells has a peculiar gift for seeing the merits of people, and he has always exhibited them in my favor. Howells has never written anything about me that I couldn't read 6 or 7 times a day. He is always just and always fair. He has written more appreciatively of me than anyone in this world, and published it in the North American Review. He did me the justice to say that my intentions, he italicized, that my intentions were always good, that I wounded people's conventions rather than their convictions. Now, I wouldn't want anything handsomer than that said of me. I would rather wait, with anything harsh I might have to say, till the convictions become conventions. Bangs has traced me all the way down. He can't find that honest man, but I will look for him in the looking glass when I get home. It was intimated by the Colonel that it is New England that makes New York and builds up this country and makes it great, overlooking the fact that there's a lot of people here who came from elsewhere, like John Hay from away out west, and Howells from Ohio, and St. Clair McKelway and me from Missouri, and we are doing what we can to build up New York a little elevated. Why, when I was living in that village of Hannibal, Missouri, on the banks of the Mississippi, and hay up in the town of Warsaw, also on the banks of the Mississippi River, it is an emotional bit of the Mississippi, and when it is low water you have to climb up to it on a ladder, and when it floods you have to hunt for it, with a deep sea lead, but it is a great and beautiful country. In that old time it was a paradise for simplicity. It was a simple, simple life, cheap but comfortable, and full of sweetness, and there was nothing of this rage of modern civilization there at all. It was a delectable land. I went out there last June, and I met in that town of Hannibal a schoolmate of mine, John Briggs, whom I had not seen for more than 50 years. I tell you, that was a meeting. that pal whom I had known as a little boy long ago, and knew now as a stately man 3 or 4 inches over 6 feet, and browned by exposure to many climes, he was back there to see that old place again. We spent a whole afternoon going about here and there and yonder, and hunting up the scenes and talking of the crimes which we had committed so long ago. It was a heartbreaking delight, full of pathos, laughter, and tears, all mixed together. And we called the roll of the boys and girls that we picnicked and sweethearted with so many years ago, and there were hardly half a dozen of them left. The rest were in their graves. And we went up there on the summit of that hill, a treasured place in my memory, the summit of Holliday's Hill, and looked out again over that magnificent panorama of the Mississippi River, sweeping along league after league, a level green paradise on one side, and retreating capes and promontories as far as you could see on the other, fading away in the soft, rich lights of the remote distance. I recognized then that I was seeing now the most enchanting river view the planet could furnish. I never knew it when I was a boy. It took an educated eye that had traveled over the globe to know and appreciate it. And John said, "Can you point out the place where Bear Creek used to be before the railroad came?" I said, "Yes, it ran along yonder." "And can you point out the swimming hole?" "Yes, out there." And he said, "Can you point out the place where we stole the skiff?" Well, I didn't know which one he meant. Such a wilderness of events had intervened since that day, more than 50 years ago, it took me more than 5 minutes to call back that little incident, and then I did call it back. It was a white skiff, and we painted it red to allay suspicion. And the saddest man came along, a stranger he was, and he looked that red skiff over so pathetically, and he said, "Well, if it weren't for the complexion, I'd know whose skiff that was." He said it in that pleading way, you know, that appeals for sympathy and suggestion. We were full of sympathy for him, but we weren't in any condition to offer suggestions. I can see him yet as he turned away with that same sad look on his face, and vanished out of history forever. I wonder what became of that man. I know what became of the skiff. Well, it was a beautiful life, a lovely life. There was no crime. Merely little things like pillaging orchards, and watermelon patches and breaking the Sabbath. We didn't break the Sabbath often enough, to signify once a week perhaps. But we were good boys, good Presbyterian boys, all Presbyterian boys, and loyal and all that. Anyway, we were good Presbyterian boys, when the weather was doubtful. When it was fair, we did wander a little from the fold. Look at John A. and me. There we were in obscurity, and look where we are now. Consider the ladder which he has climbed, the illustrious vocations he has served, and vocations is the right word. He has in all those vocations acquitted himself with high credit and honor to his country, and to the mother that bore him. Scholar, soldier, diplomat, poet, historian, now, see where we are. He is Secretary of State, and I am a gentleman. It could not happen in any other country. Our institutions give men the positions that of right belong to them through merit. All you men have won your places, not by heredities, and not by family influence or extraneous help, but only by the natural gifts God gave you at your birth, made effective by your own energies. This is the country to live in. Now, there is one invisible guest here. A part of me is present. The larger part, the better part, is yonder at her home. That is my wife. And as he has a good many personal friends here, and I think it won't distress any one of them to know that, although she is going to be confined to that bed for many months, to come from that nervous prostration, there is not any danger, and she is coming along very well, and I think it quite appropriate that I should speak of her. I knew her for the first time just in the same year that I first knew John A. and Tom Reed and Mr. Twitchell 36 years ago, and S. he has been the best friend I have ever had, and that is saying a good deal. S. he has reared me, she and Twitchell together, and what I am I owe to them. Twitchell, why, it is such a pleasure to look upon Twitchell's face. for 25 years I was under the Rev. Mr. Twitchell's tuition. I was in his pastorate, occupying a pew in his church, and held him in due reverence. That man is full of all the graces that go to make a person companionable and beloved. And wherever Twitchell goes to start a church, the people flock there to buy the land. They find real estate goes up all around the spot, and the envious and the thoughtful always try to get Twitchell to move to their neighborhood and start a church. And wherever you see him go, you can go and buy land there with confidence, feeling sure that there will be a double price for you before very long. I am not saying this to flatter Mr. Twitchell. It is the fact. Many and many a time I have attended the annual sale in his church, and bought up all the pews on a margin, and it would have been better for me spiritually and financially if I had stayed under his wing. I have tried to do good in this world, and it is marvelous in how many different ways I have done good, and it is comfortable to reflect now. There's Mr. Rogers, just out of the affection I bear that man, many a time I have given him points in finance that he had never thought of, and if he could lay aside envy, prejudice, and superstition, and utilize those ideas in his business, it would make a difference in his bank account. Well, I like the poetry. I like all the speeches and the poetry too. I like Dr. Van Dyke's poem. I wish I could return thanks in proper measure to you, gentlemen, who have spoken and violated your feelings to pay me compliments. Some were merited, and some you overlooked, it is true, and Colonel Harvey did slander every one of you, and put things into my mouth that I never said, never thought of at all. And now, my wife and I, out of our single heart, return you our deepest and most grateful thanks, and yesterday was her birthday. To the Whitefriars, address at the dinner given by the Whitefriars Club in honor of Mr. Clemens, London, June 20, 1899. The Whitefriars Club was founded by Dr. Samuel Johnson, and Mr. Clemens was made an honorary member in 1874. The members are representative of literary and journalistic London. The toast of our guest was proposed by Louis F. Austin, of the Illustrated London News, and in the course of some humorous remarks he referred to the vow, and to the imaginary woes of the Briars, as the members of the club style themselves. Mr. Chairman and Brethren of the Vow, in whatever the vow is, for although I have been a member of this club for 25 years, I don't know any more about what that vow is than Mr. Austin seems to. But whatever the vow is, I don't care what it is. I have made 1,000 vows. There is no pleasure comparable to making a vow in the presence of one who appreciates that vow, in the presence of men who honor and appreciate you for making the vow, and men who admire you for making the vow. There is only one pleasure higher than that, and that is to get outside and break the vow. A vow is always a pledge of some kind or other for the protection of your own morals and principles or somebody else's, and generally, by the irony of fate, it is for the protection of your own morals. Hence we have pledges that make us eschew tobacco or wine, and while you are taking the pledge there is a holy influence about that makes you feel you are reformed, and that you can never be so happy again in this world until you get outside and take a drink. I had forgotten that I was a member of this club, it is so long ago. But now I remember that I was here 25 years ago, and that I was then at a dinner of the Whitefriars Club, and it was in those old days when you had just made 2 great finds. All London was talking about nothing else than that they had found Livingston, and that the lost Sir Roger Tichburne had been found, and they were trying him for it. And at the dinner, Chairman, I do not know who he was, failed to come to time. The gentleman who had been appointed to pay me the customary compliments and to introduce me forgot the compliments and did not know what they were. And George Augustus Sala came in at the last moment, just when I was about to go without compliments altogether. And that man was a gifted man. They just called on him instantaneously while he was going to sit down, to introduce the stranger, and Salah made one of those marvelous speeches which he was capable of making. I think no man talked so fast as Salah did. One did not need wine while he was making a speech. The rapidity of his utterance made a man drunk in a minute. An incomparable speech was that, an impromptu speech, and an impromptu speech is a seldom thing, and he did it so well. He went into the whole history of the United States, and made it entirely new to me. He filled it with episodes and incidents that Washington never heard of, and he did it so convincingly that, although I knew none of it had happened, from that day to this, I do not know any history but Salah's. I do not know anything so sad as a dinner, where you are going to get up and say something by and by, and you do not know what it is. You sit and wonder what the gentleman is going to say who is going to introduce you. You know that, if he says something severe, that if he will deride you, or traduce you, or do anything of that kind, he will furnish you with a text, because anybody can get up and talk against that. Anybody can get up and straighten out his character. But when a gentleman gets up, and merely tells the truth about you, what can you do? Mr. Austin has done well. He has supplied so many texts that I will have to drop out a lot of them, and that is about as difficult as when you do not have any text at all. Now, he made a beautiful and smooth speech without any difficulty at all, and I could have done that if I had gone on with the schooling with which I began. I see here a gentleman on my left who was my master in the art of oratory more than 25 years ago. When I look upon the inspiring face of Mr. Depew, it carries me a long way back. An old and valued friend of mine is he, and I saw his career as it came along, and it has reached pretty well up to now, when he, by another miscarriage of justice, is a United States Senator. But those were delightful days, when I was taking lessons in oratory. My other master, the ambassador, is not here yet. Under those two gentlemen I learned to make after-dinner speeches, and it was charming. You know the New England dinner is the great occasion on the other side of the water. It is held every year, to celebrate the landing of the pilgrims. Those pilgrims were a lot of people who were not needed in England, and you know they had great rivalry, and they were persuaded to go elsewhere, and they chartered a ship called Mayflower and set sail, and I have heard it said that they pumped the Atlantic Ocean through that ship 16 times. They fell in over there with the Dutch from Rotterdam, Amsterdam, and a lot of other places with profane names, and it is from that gang that Mr. Depew is descended. On the other hand, Mr. Choate is descended from those Puritans who landed on a bitter night in December. Every year those people used to meet at a great banquet in New York, and those masters of mind in oratory had to make speeches. It was Dr. Depew's business to get up there and apologize for the Dutch, and Mr. Choate had to get up later and explain the crimes of the Puritans, and grand, beautiful times we used to have. It is curious that after that long lapse of time I meet the Whitefriars again, some looking as young and fresh as in the old days, others showing a certain amount of wear and tear, and here, after all this time, I find one of the masters of oratory, and the others named in the list. And here we three meet again as exiles on one pretext or another, and you will notice that, while we are absent there is a pleasing tranquility in America, a building up of public confidence. We are doing the best we can for our country. I think we have spent our lives in serving our country, and we never serve it to greater advantage than when we get out of it. But impromptu speaking, that is what I was trying to learn. That is a difficult thing. I used to do it in this way. I used to begin about a week ahead, and write out my impromptu speech and get it by heart. Then I brought it to the New England dinner printed on a piece of paper in my pocket, so that I could pass it to the reporters all cut and dried, and in order to do an impromptu speech as it should be done you have to indicate the places for pauses and hesitations. I put them all in it. And then you want the applause in the right places. When I got to the place where it should come in, if it did not come in I did not care, but I had it marked in the paper. And these masters of mine used to wonder why it was my speech came out in the morning in the first person, while theirs went through the butchery of synopsis. I do that kind of speech,
I mean an offhand speech,
and do it well, and make no mistake in such a way, to deceive the audience completely, and make that audience believe it is an impromptu speech that is art. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.